dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WUS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Olympia 91.3, and on the web for now, Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org and Knoxville First Amendment Radio, kfar.org. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we're going to continue with audio from the 9/11 Citizens Commission hearings held in New York City last month. The information we're going to present is explosive, and if the commercial mass media covered what you're about to hear, it would change the world. One way that you can make a difference is to tape this program and pass it on, especially to someone with a Bush-Cheney campaign sign in their yard. Because the so-called free press in this country has been sold off to the same corporate state complex that also owns the government of the United States. And as you will hear in the program tonight, my phrasing this in this way is not hyperbole or rhetoric, but fact. Meanwhile, this week, attacks by the federal government continued against our few truly independent media organizations. On October 8th, under a mutual law enforcement treaty with the UK, the FBI seized two servers from an internet service provider hosting more than 20 websites of the worldwide independent media center network IndyMedia. The ISP Rackspace turned over the servers without first notifying IndyMedia and told some of the group's volunteers, quote, they cannot provide IndyMedia with any information regarding the order, close quote. ISPs have received gag orders in similar situations which prevent them from informing the parties involved about what is happening. A statement issued by Rackspace about the seizure said they were being, quote, good corporate citizens, unquote, by complying with international law enforcement efforts. In August, the U.S. Secret Service used a subpoena in an attempt to disrupt the New York City Independent Media Center before the Republican National Convention by trying to get logs from an ISP in the U.S. and the Netherlands. Last month, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission shut down several community radio stations around the U.S., for broadcasting without a license. 2 weeks ago, the FBI asked IndyMedia to remove a post on the Nantes, France IMC that had a photo of some undercover Swiss police. And IMC volunteers in Seattle were visited by the FBI on the same issue. The Nantes IMC is one of those that was operating on the servers that were seized Friday. IndyMedia said the list of local media collectives affected included Amazonia, Uruguay, Andorra, Poland, Western Massachusetts, Nice, Nantes, Lille, and Marseille in France, Euskal Herria in the Basque country, Liège, East and West Vlaanderen, Antwerpen, all in Belgium, Belgrade, Portugal, Prague, Galicia, Italy, Brazil, UK, part of the German site, and the Global IndyMedia Radio site. Residents of the Finger Lakes, at least, will have an opportunity to voice their views on the issue of media ownership in a public forum with Congressman Maurice Hinchey and FCC Commissioner Michael Copps and local experts. This will take place Tuesday, October 19th, from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m., at the Emerson Suites at Ithaca College. The event is free and open to the public, and I'm planning to attend that event and tape that for later broadcast. For those of you who are not able to get over to Ithaca College during a weekday during normal business hours. And so now we continue with audio from the 9/11 Citizens Commission, as investigative journalist Michael Rupert of From the Wilderness takes the stand. The three-person commission is chaired by former Georgia Congresswoman and present congressional candidate Cynthia McKinney, with commissioners Bob McElvain, whose son perished in the World Trade Center, and Dr. Faiz Khan, a New York City emergency room doctor and imam.
Congresswoman McKinney, Dr. Khan, Mr. McElvain, fellow citizens, it is an honor to be here today to discuss some of the most serious issues ever to present themselves before a free people. There are many things I do not need to say here today. Others will say them for all of us. Almost all of us are deeply aware of and disturbed by the glaring inconsistencies, the evidence tampering, the obstruction of justice, the nonfeasance, the malfeasance, and the other crimes represented by the final report of the Kane Commission investigating the attacks of September the 11th. I will not digress to discuss them here, but for the record, I would like it noted that the entire membership of the Kane Commission is horribly and blatantly compromised by often egregious conflicts of interest that would have made them ineligible for participation in the tribunal charged with rendering a full accounting of the events of 9/11. Their conduct in the discharge of their duties was a shameful and criminal affirmation of those vested interests. Since the day of the attacks, my newsletter, From the Wilderness, reinforced by an incredible staff of writers and editors, has worked virtually nonstop to investigate those attacks and to produce reasonable answers based upon evidence that will help fill the enormous void left by mainstream news organizations, the Congress, and the Kane Commission. As most of you know, my long-awaited book, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, has just recently been completed, and even as we speak today, the printing is starting in Canada. So we're very happy to see that. I am especially. We have been accepting advance orders for a week, and the first shipment should go out by September 14th. So those of you who have been waiting for that book, which is 700 pages long with 1,000 footnotes, plenty for all of you to digest, challenge, and do whatever you want to do with, it'll be available for you shortly, and we certainly hope before November 2nd. I don't know why I'd say something like that. You can find information about the book at the website fromthewilderness.com. I believe that Crossing the Rubicon provides amply documented evidence with which to initiate and sustain a number of indictments of top-level government officials for their roles in facilitating the attacks of 9/11. Most notably, as my chief suspect, I name Vice President Richard Cheney as both a planner and executor of those attacks. In order to complete my book, I chose to focus on a clear and unmistakable evidentiary record based upon written records, statements of key officials, evidence presented under oath in first-person interviews, and investigations conducted by me directly in pursuit of information that discloses the truth about September the 11th. I chose to avoid discussion of physical evidence issues for two primary reasons. First, physical evidence arguments based upon photographic and other analyses are not directly court admissible without overcoming several hurdles. First, a clear and irrefutable chain of custody backed up by affidavits or sworn testimony is required to even get such evidence admitted at trial. Secondly, such evidence is by definition only presentable in court at a time presentable or identifiable in court or discussable in court by means of expert witness testimony, which is often subject to intense courtroom debate and judged only by the amount of money which can be brought to bear to produce experts to either validate or refute it. In writing Crossing the Rubicon, I decided that the primary audience that I wanted to reach was the American people as a whole. I thought it best to present them with a book that I could say was legally admissible in court on its face, since no interpretation was required and no chain of custody issues presented themselves with regards to footnotes or verifiable records. The possibility of evidence tampering has been removed, since all footnotes lead either to verifiable public record sources or are the work product of interviews conducted and recorded by me that I recount in the book as I would sworn testimony of a detective under oath. Since I have only 15 minutes to deliver my prepared remarks before going to questions, let me begin by briefly summarizing my findings, briefly, and disclosing information which has never been made public until today. Crossing the Rubicon is a detective story that gets to the innermost core of the 9/11 attacks. It places 9/11 at the center of a desperate new America created by specific named individuals in preparation for peak oil, an economic crisis like nothing the world has ever seen. It looks at the crime from the viewpoint of a homicide investigator who must, in order to establish guilt, examine and identify the motive, means, and opportunity for the commission of the crime. The attacks of September 11, 2001 were the pretext for the American and, to a lesser extent, the British and the Israeli empires to begin seizing by force those energy supplies needed to sustain their power, hegemony, whether regional or global, and their teetering economies. Both governments were involved well before the attacks occurred. The attacks of 9/11 were accomplished through an amazing orchestration of logistics and personnel. Former National Security Advisor and Counterterror Advisor Richard Clark has postulated that such a conspiracy could never be kept a secret. Too many people would have been involved, he insisted in his recent book, Against All Enemies. On this point, I disagree with Clark completely and point to the fact that the Manhattan Project, which developed the atom bomb, and the Stealth Fighter Project were both successfully kept secret. The numbers of people involved in both of those projects far exceeded the numbers of people within the United States government required to execute 9/11. However, I must express a deep debt of gratitude to Richard Clark, for in his book he left a very compelling trail of breadcrumbs, contradictions to the sworn testimony and written records submitted, often under oath, of our highest leaders, and the hard evidence which provided me with the leads I needed to break open and answer the whodunit part of 9/11. For me, the pivotal evidence, absolutely demonstrating direct government complicity in and management of the attacks, was found in a number of undisputed yet virtually unaddressed war games that I have shown were being conducted, coordinated, and or controlled by Vice President Dick Cheney or his immediate staff on the morning of September the 11th. The names of those war games are known to include Vigilant Guardian, Vigilant Warrior, Northern Guardian, Northern Vigilance, and Tripod 2. There is a possibility that Northern Guardian, excuse me, is a duplicate name, but the remaining exercises are indisputably separate events with different objectives. All have been reported by major press organizations relying on undisputed quotes from participating military and FAA personnel. They have also been confirmed by NORAD press releases. All except for Northern Vigilance and Tripod 2 had to do with hijacked airliners inside the continental United States, specifically within the Northeast Air Defense Sector, or NEADS, where all four 9/11 hijackings occurred. According to a clear record, some of these exercises involve commercial airline hijackings. In some cases, false blips or injects were deliberately inserted onto FAA and military radar screens, and they were present during at least the first attacks. Excuse me. This effectively paralyzed fighter response, because with only 8 fighters available in the region, there were as many as 22 possible hijackings taking place. Other exercises, specifically Northern Vigilance, had pulled significant fighter resources away from the Northeast U.S. just before 9/11 into Northern Canada and Alaska. In addition, a close reading of key news stories published in the spring of 2004 revealed for the first time that some of these drills were live fly exercises, where actual aircraft, likely flown by remote control, were simulating the behavior of hijacked airliners in real life. All of this as the real attacks began. The fact that these exercises had never been systematically and thoroughly explored in the mainstream press, or publicly by Congress, or at least publicly in any detail whatsoever by the so-called Independent 9/11 Commission, made me think that they might be the holy grail of 9/11. And that's exactly what they turned out to be. Only one war game exercise, Vigilant Guardian, was mentioned in a footnote to the Kane Commission report, and that it was deliberately mislabeled as an exercise intended to intercept Russian bombers instead of a hijack exercise in the Northeast sector. Even then, a deliberate lie was told to the American people as NORAD Commander General Ralph Eberhardt testified to the commission that the exercise actually expedited U.S. Air Force response during the attacks. Before the commission's final hearing, I undertook a direct investigation in an attempt to learn more details about each of the exercises and specifically who was controlling them or had planned them to take place on September the 11th. where it's abundantly clear, based upon the record of statements made by the U.S. Air Force and FAA personnel, that the games had effectively paralyzed fighter response during the attacks. While most of my queries, including the submission of direct written questions and telephone calls to NORAD, the Department of Defense, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, resulted in stonewalling, that's a kind word, and did little to help clarify this key issue, one military officer revealed information that was, to say the least, startling. It confirmed my findings. After several phone calls and lengthy emails laying out what I had uncovered, I received a written response from First Air Force Public Affairs Officer Major Don Arias. In that response, he confirmed that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had been conducting a lifeline hijack drill on the day of September the 11th. The name of that exercise, Vigilant Warrior, had been revealed by Richard Clark on page 9 of his book as he quoted a statement made to him by then acting Joint Chiefs Chairman Richard Myers. To excerpt from Major Arias' May 14th, 2004 email addressed to me, Mr. Rupert, the book is in the mail. That's an Air Force book which describes a completely different set of attacks than the one the Keene Commission investigated. The NORAD-wide exercise we were in on 9/11 was indeed Vigilant Guardian. I also learned something that may help you with your research. The terms used for NORAD exercises have specific meanings. Per NORAD Instruction 33-7, nicknames, quote, a combination of two separate unclassified words, which is assigned an unclassified meaning and is employed for unclassified administration, morale, or public information, the first word must begin with the combination of letters of the alphabet allocated to the using agency. It's all mil-speak, as they call it. A nickname is used exclusively to designate a drill or exercise. Exercise terms are used to prevent confusion between exercise directives with actual operations. That's the key sentence because they have to separate the exercises from real life, at least they're supposed to. Vigilant or amalgam means it is a HQ and headquarters NORAD sponsored exercise. Guardian means it is a multi-command CPX or command post exercise, meaning there's no live fly. So on 9/11, NORAD was conducting NORAD-wide multi-command command post exercises with no live flies. This covers the radar injects that were present on the FAA radar screens throughout New England and the Northeast sector on that day. Other exercise terms include Warrior, JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, Headquarters NORAD, sponsored field training exercise, or FTX, or live fly. Because First Air Force CONAR is an intermediate level of command, I may have to refer your questions to HQ NORAD, but I'll do what I can. But what he said was, we have General Richard Myers saying, Vigilant Warrior, we're in the middle of it. Richard Clark wrote it in the book. A NORAD officer here confirms that that was a live fly hijack drill in progress during the attacks. Have you ever heard of that before? Any of you? The full text in this of this and other correspondence and my direct questioning of DOD and military personnel is included in Crossing the Rubicon. Major Arias is going to be mentioned again very quickly here. What we have in this instance is direct written confirmation of a live fly exercise that involved the actual piloting of aircraft either by remote control or with real pilots in the Northeast Air Defense sector. There are multiple confirmations of this, which are in the book. Other exercises use the injects, confusing both FAA and NORAD radar screens. And this would account for well-documented confusion over what might have been 22 different possible hijackings. It was impossible for the FAA or the Air Force personnel to tell which was which. With only 8 fighter aircraft available, the inexplicable delays in fighter response are now easy to comprehend. When New York writer Michael Caine, who I believe is here today, wherever you are, Mike, God bless you, approached General Eberhardt on an FTW assignment for my newsletter at the conclusion of the Commission's last public hearing, and asked for information on all the other exercises, including Vigilant Warrior, Eberhardt's only response was, no comment. Other government agencies have fallen back on a simple, the exercises are classified excuse and failed to provide any clarification at all. Same with the Caine Commission, several members of which were also questioned by Mike Caine. Nobody would talk. There was also an additional non-military biowarfare exercise called Tripod 2 being set up in Manhattan on September 11th. And it was under the direct coordination of FEMA and by White House directive, the immediate control of the Vice President, Richard Cheney. The setup for that exercise conveniently placed a fully staffed FEMA New York City Department of Justice command post on Manhattan's Pier 29, just in time for it to be conveniently used as the command post after the Twin Towers had collapsed. In reconstructing actual communications and chains of commands, I was extremely disturbed to find out that many officials in a position to take action that might have prevented the loss of life in the South Tower did not do so before Flight 175 became the second impact. This in spite of the fact that it was known and had been clearly communicated that Flight 175 had been off course, hijacked, and headed toward Manhattan for some 20 minutes. Included here are Vice President Richard Cheney, various NORAD officers and commanders, the FAA, and then Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. In examining transcripts of Giuliani's testimony before the Kane Commission, I find clear evidence suggesting that Mayor Giuliani committed perjury when he appeared before the Kane Commission this spring. It's interesting to note that of all 9/11 witnesses whose testimony I analyzed, his testimony remain to this day the only testimony which has not been transcribed and presented to the public. Instead, I was forced to rely on transcripts prepared from video and audio recordings by 9/11 activists and researchers. I will now quote from Crossing the Rubicon as to what my analysis of Giuliani's testimony revealed. It may explain why the Kane Commission has deliberately withheld it from public view. I want to thank first Kyle Hentz and Joe Friendly, who provided me with a written transcript of Giuliani's remarks, which I might add was independently verified through other recordings. We began, according to Giuliani, sometime after Flight 77 struck the Pentagon. Quote, I had already been informed by my chief of staff that he had reached the White House and by the police commissioner, who I think had reached the Defense Department. I'm not sure exactly. But both of them had assured me that we had gotten air support because that's why I wanted to reach the White House. I wanted to make sure that we had air defense for the city. And my chief of staff told me that he was informed by the White House that there were 7 planes that were unaccounted for. At this point, I knew of 2, and I heard reports that the Pentagon had been attacked, that the Sears Tower had been attacked, and several other things. Now, who had told, I'm speaking now, who had told Giuliani about the 2 missing planes before this? Such information must have originated with NORAD, NEADS, or the FAA. Those communications channels were obviously functioning at that time, but then why no warning? The only likely explanation here is that lower command levels, knowing that the National Command Authority, the White House, and the Pentagon had taken command, assumed that the warnings would come from higher up and thus be more quickly heeded. Now we go back to Giuliani. So I got through to the White House. Chris Hennick was on the phone, who was the deputy political director to President Bush. And I said to him, Chris, was the Pentagon attacked? And he said, confirmed. Note, the Pentagon was struck at 9:41. And then I asked him if we had air support. I said, do we have air support? Do you have jets out? Because I think we're going to get hit again. He said, quote, the jets were dispatched 12 minutes ago, and they should be there very shortly, and they should be able to defend you against further attack. It's Christmas. Jingle bells, okay, against further attack. And then he said, we're evacuating the White House and the Vice President will call you back very shortly. Note a number of mainstream press accounts, this is me, fixed the White House evacuation order between 9:41 and 9:45. I think it was a lot earlier. But thus, there are 2 events fixing Giuliani's conversation with Hennick at between 9:41 and 9:45. Are we to assume that no one in the White House had Giuliani's telephone number? He was a major player in the Republican Party, a strong supporter of George W. Bush. Why was he talking to a political director and not to the Pentagon or the Situation Room and the White House? Clark was there. Rice was there. The Situation Room was hooked up to NORAD, the Pentagon, the FAA, the FBI, everybody. He or somebody on his staff had the numbers. The problem with the Giuliani-Hennick call is that its timing is bounded by 3 parameters that don't fit. The call starts sometime after the Pentagon was hit at 9:41. Hennick tells Giuliani that fighters were dispatched 12 minutes ago to protect you, i.e. New York City, and we know that the only fighters sent to New York were sent from Otis Air Force Base at 8:46. 12 minutes after that would be 8:58. South Tower was struck at 9:03. The end of the Giuliani-Hennick call is followed immediately by the start of the Cheney-Giuliani call, see below, and the immediate collapse of the World WTC Tower at South Tower at 9:59. For the sake of argument, let's say that this conversation occurred 5 minutes after the Pentagon was struck. That would mean that the White House told Giuliani that fighter aircraft had been scrambled and sent to New York 7 minutes after 9:37 or 9:41, depending upon which timeline is used, or between 9:44 and 9:48. The final Kane Commission report, released on July 22nd, makes no mention of any fighters being sent to New York at this time. The only scramble order even close to Giuliani's account is the scrambling of fighters from Langley Air Force Base to protect Washington at 9:23. Roughly matches the timing of Giuliani's conversation with Hennick. The former mayor's testimony appears to be referring to the Otis fighters that had been directed to establish a combat air patrol over New York. But that poses another problem, a big one. If this is the case, then Giuliani's testimony places the Otis scramble order almost an hour later than the official NORAD and NEADS accounts, Northeast Air Defense Sector. Were these some other fighter aircraft? If so, they have not been mentioned. And why did Hennick not mention the Otis fighters that were, according to NORAD and eyewitness accounts, already in a very visible low-altitude combat air patrol over Manhattan? Anybody here that day didn't hear or see the fighters? Giuliani should have been able to see and hear them. Every other New Yorker saw them. Are we to believe that Giuliani somehow remained oblivious to the fighters' presence? Are we to believe that no police or fire official told him that the fighters were there, that he couldn't hear them? The only available benchmarks suggest that the call from Cheney took place much earlier than Giuliani claims. If we reference it to when the scramble order was issued at Otis Air Force Base, the source of New York's fighter cover, 8:46 a.m., then Giuliani spoke to Hennick sometime around 8:58 or about 5 minutes before Flight 175 struck at 9:03. If Hennick knew about other missing planes, he was obviously getting information, at least indirectly, from NORAD and NEADS. From whom? A political guy getting this information. The Secret Service seems the most likely candidate since there are numerous records of their active involvement by this time. At that time, it was also known that Flight 175 had been en route to Lower Manhattan for 16 minutes. There is no mention of Hennick issuing any warning to the New York mayor that a second plane was about to attack. How could the White House staffer have been certain about 12 minutes? Unless there had been a log. He was precise. Where is that log? Why was a political staffer in possession of better data than the mayor of New York? What does this suggest, then, about the timing of the call that Giuliani then received from Dick Cheney immediately after talking to Hennick? I'm quoting Giuliani. And I put down the phone and within seconds got a call in another room from the vice president. I walked over to that room, picked up the phone. The White House operator was on the phone and said, "Mr. Mayor, the vice president will be on in a moment." At that point, I heard a click. The desk started to shake, and I heard Chief Esposito, who was the uniformed head of the police department. I'm sure it was his voice. I heard him say, "The South Tower is down. The tower has come down." The South Tower collapsed at 9:59 and was recorded live by a multitude of cameras. This is confirmation that Cheney was making command decisions and in all communications loops at least by this time. But if the White House call took place at 8:58, then more likely, in conformity with what we have already established, Dick Cheney was actually hands-on much, much sooner. As we have seen, Cheney was already in that role between 8:45, according to the FAA, and no later than about 9:15. The Secret Service, which had snatched Cheney out of his office after Flight 175 hit at 9:03, was fully informed of all developments, and they never left Dick Cheney's side. Quoting Giuliani, "So the police commissioner and I and the deputy police commissioner, we jointly decided we had to try to get everyone out of the building. So we went downstairs into the basement. We tried two or three exits, could not get out. I don't know if they were locked or blocked, but we couldn't get out." Here is more agonizing confirmation that no evacuation warnings had been issued for either tower prior to 9:02. Yet full knowledge of the danger was available to the National Command Authority that Flight 175 had turned toward New York at 8:42. 20 silent minutes passed when many of those who died could have been saved. The failure to warn the occupants of the South Tower, in spite of what is now an irrefutable record, is not only a grave insult to the people of New York, but the implications are compounded by the fact that Major Don Arias, the same NORAD officer who provided me with written confirmation of a live fly exercise, had a brother working inside the World Trade Center during the attacks. While the entire national command system failed to issue any warning to the people in the World Trade Center, Major Arias was compelled to leave his post long enough to place a phone call over a standard phone line to call his brother to warn him to get out of the building. Nobody else would do it. All of this is abundantly documented in Crossing the Rubicon. There are many, many other instances of criminal conduct on the part of our government on September 11th and since. I could talk about the still unresolved issue of massive insider trading on the world's financial markets. I could talk about a multitude of specific warnings that were received but ignored by George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and the entire administration. I could talk about how retired FBI Special Agent John O'Neill was kept out drinking until 2:30 in the morning on the night before the attacks, in a pattern very reminiscent of what happened with several Secret Service agents assigned to protect President John Kennedy on November 22, 1963. One of the most insulting omissions of the Keene Commission is its failure to even discuss a $100,000 wire transfer to Mohammed Atta just a few days before the attack at the order of then of the head of Pakistan's intelligence services, the ISI, or that, as Paul mentioned, General Ahmad was having breakfast with Porter Goss, the man who was now being put forth to head our Central Intelligence Agency. But one thing I am certain of, and I believe I have proven the case beyond a reasonable doubt in Crossing the Rubicon, I am absolutely certain that Richard Cheney was not only a planner in the attacks, but also that on the day of the attacks, he was running a completely separate command and control and communication system, which was superseding any orders being issued by the National Military Command Center, that's the Pentagon, or the White House Situation Room. To accomplish that end, he relied on a redundant and superior communication system maintained by the United States Secret Service in or near the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the bunker, to which he and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice were reportedly rushed sometime after Flight 175 struck the South Tower. I will demonstrate that the Secret Service possessed radar screens which gave them and the Vice President, whose side they never left, real-time information as good or better than anything available to the Pentagon, the FAA, or anybody else, and that it was on the basis of that information that Cheney overrode and took complete operational control on September the 11th. I have shown that in what are called national special security events. I encourage you to all Google that on your computers. The U.S. Secret Service is the supreme U.S. agency for operational control with complete authority over the military and all civilian agencies. I have established conclusively that in May 2001, by presidential order, Richard Cheney was put in direct command and control of all war game and field exercise training and scheduling through several agencies, especially FEMA. This also extended to all of the conflicting and overlapping NORAD drills. I will also demonstrate that the tripod exercise being set up on September 10th in Manhattan was directly connected to Cheney's role in number three above. By sheer dedication and sacrifice through endless hours of labor and uncounted sleepless nights, a great many true Americans have kept 9/11 on the table. There's a few of them right here, a few of them here, there. 9/11 on the table for review and examination by the people of the world, and especially the people of America. It remains a clear and irrefutable challenge for all of us to persevere, to remain steadfast, to demand accountability, and to take whatever personal risks are necessary to see justice done and to unravel the confusing, perilous, and often frightening world which has presented itself to us in the years since. I welcome your questions.
Mike Rupert, author of Crossing the Rubicon, testifying on September 9, 2004, before the 9/11 Citizens Commission in New York City. Commission Chairperson Cynthia McKinney.
So I will ask Commissioner Khan to go first with the series of questions that he has now while I continue to go through these questions from you, the audience.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and ask the audience questions. It's really tempting to expand and pontificate, but just for the sake of time, we want to keep the answers short and terse. There's a lot of detail that we can look up on our own, but just short, quick answers would be great. I guess this one I can ask Mike and then have Paul also comment. Any proof yet that bin Laden was responsible for September 11th?
From a criminal standpoint, in terms of the way you would approach it to court of law, which is how I approach everything, the answer is no. The case has not been made. I believe Osama bin Laden has been and remains a CIA asset and protected. Yeah.
Just hold applause for 1 minute. Paul, any comments?
As you may guess from my earlier talk, I see a lot of evidence of knowledge of the attacks in Afghanistan in the months before 9/11. However, Osama bin Laden appears to be more of a kind of a spiritual figure, a symbolic leader. We can see a lot of other people who we could call masterminds who would be way ahead of the list, in my opinion, over him.
Thank you. Cynthia, do you have a question? Or do you want me to keep going?
No, keep going.
Okay. This, I guess, would be best handled by Barry. Barry, what can we, I mean, you've all pretty much ripped apart the credibility of the commissions. We've explored the illegitimacy of being dogmatic about anything we hear in the corporate mainstream media. What can we do to expose or put pressure on the corporate media to cover the 9/11 truth issue? Concrete steps.
Boy, I wish I knew. They're a huge problem. And I've been struggling with them for three decades. You just work. You do what you can. There are people within the media who are legitimate. They're authentic. There are fugitive paragraphs. There are excellent particular columnists and so on. And I think that people should recognize them, praise them, help them, link up with them, write letters to the editor. Simple as it seems, it's a powerful thing. The letters to the editor column of a newspaper or magazine is usually the second best thing, second best read item in that section in that paper. So those are some of the things you can do, and don't give up.
Commissioner Faiz Khan, MD.
I can't read this one. The writing is too sloppy. Sorry.
Oh, I could read it. That's why I gave
he's
it to
a doctor.
You.
Should,
I'm a doctor. That's a bad prognostic sign for somebody's penmanship.
Why has David Ray Graham's finding...
Griffin.
Griffiths, that's right. Findings attacking the official version and the attack on WTC and the... Pentagon not received
more attention
in the U.S. media.
In other words, why isn't Griffin's book receiving the press and the media attention it should receive?
Who, is that directed to anybody?
How about Barry?
Again, it's de facto censorship that occurs. I personally contacted twice the letters editor of the Toronto Star, it's the largest paper in Canada, drawing to his attention, his name's Dan Smith, drawing to his attention the publication of David Ray Griffin's book, that it was selling very well on Amazon, that it was extremely timely because it came out around the time of the 9/11 commission, and I said I thought it was worth reviewing. I have yet to see a review. Way back when Charles Higham wrote a tremendous book called Trading with the Enemy, that shows that Ford and General Motors and ITT and Sterling Drugs and others worked actively with the Nazis before and during the Second World War. He wrote a book that the libel insurance company charged one of the lowest premiums that it ever charged because it was so well documented. It's a classic to this day, hardly reviewed anywhere to this day. That book's about 20 years old. And I believe that Michael, to my left here, has made a comment a while back about it not being an accident that there are so many books that no one's heard about or that are out of print.
That was Barry Zwicker, Canadian documentary filmmaker and media critic.
Great. Paul?
Yeah, I'd also like to add that in Britain, actually, his book has gotten a lot more coverage. He's been on national television. He's been mentioned in a big review in the Daily Mail, which is one of the biggest papers there. Book has done very well over there. And this is something I've seen in my research, is that often for events in the United States, we have to turn to the European media to get some decent coverage.
Thank you. It's called
The New Pearl Harbor
by David Ray Griffin.
May I add a 10-second observation?
Sure, Mike, please.
I describe this in detail in Crossing the Rubicon because you have to establish the ecosystem in which all of this takes place. And it is a financial ecosystem in which all of the corporate media in this country trades their stock on Wall Street, governed by price-to-earnings ratios, governed by cheap energy, governed by drug cash being laundered through the banking system, governed by, in other words, when a flock of birds changes direction, is it a conspiracy or is it just because all the birds know that's their common interest to do or not do something? And so there is that herd mentality. The way you overcome that is you make more people go listen to independent media than are listening to the mainstream media, and it makes the mainstream media jealous.
Thank you.
When you feel exhausted, you're worse
than okay. All right, this is a question that needs some addressing in terms of paradigm shift. And I want to, Mike, I want to ask you your opinion on this, and I guess all of you. The terrorists and bin Laden have obviously declared war on the U.S.
Is that it?
No. What do they want, number one? Wars are usually started to gain something. What do they hope to gain?
Okay. Well, first of all, I do not accept the construct that 19 Muslim hijackers perpetrated the attacks of 9/11 out of a cave in Afghanistan. What we are faced with, though, is what some people, and I don't agree with this completely, a concept called blowback, in which many of these Muslim fundamentalist organizations were deliberately created by the United States government through covert policy in the late 70s, early 80s, throughout the Afghani-Soviet insurgency. Where people like Zbigniew Brzezinski were, you know, boasting about it. I mean, that's where we see radical hate books that are used in some Muslim schools having been printed at the University of Nebraska under the same contract that was printing oil drilling manuals for UNICAL, which is true. By the same token, I was a policeman in South Central Los Angeles, and I will say that if you stand on anybody's neck long enough, they're going to get upset and they're going to try to fight back. That is a legitimate human right of self-defense. What anybody, I think, wants, and I, you know, I'm not advocating terrorism in any form or violence in any form, but what I'm saying is that some people fight back, and certainly there were terrorists who wanted to attack the United States before 9/11. There are probably five times that many since 9/11, based solely upon the conduct of the United States government in world affairs since.
Thank you. I just have a comment to add to Mike's. You know, extremist and fundamentalist ideology has been around since the earliest centuries of the Islamic religion, of Christianity, of Judaism, of Buddhism, of Hinduism. The question I think that needs to be asked that Mike is investigating is, who funds these guys, who empowers them, who gives them logistical information, and who promotes their ideology? Mike, in your opinion, is there a marriage between Wall Street, CIA, and the militant Islamic networks?
Well, first of all, the CIA is Wall Street. And Wall Street is the CIA. There is no difference. I got a whole chapter on that in the book that's a real eye-opener. But I think I look at this historically. Congresswoman McKinney served on the House International Relations Committee, and I know that you had pretty good terms with Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California.
Yes.
And I document a long litany where Dana Rohrabacher absolutely incensed about how the U.S. was deliberately supporting the Taliban and al-Qaeda with arms and cutting off the arms to anybody who opposed al-Qaeda, was literally almost slamming his shoe like Nikita Khrushchev did on the table, chewing out a State Department official. He was after a guy named Carl Inderfirth, who was in my book, saying it's Pakistan, 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 meaning that the United States government, through the CIA with its relationship with the ISI, was deliberately acting as a nurse, if you will, suckling and protecting the Taliban and making sure that it grew.
Thank you. Mike, do you have any comments to add about the Osama bin Laden, the militant Islamic networks, and their commitment to declare war on the United States?
Michael Springman, former U.S. diplomat at the embassy in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, now an attorney in private practice.
Well, I think the world is beginning to see in a little bit that there are more viewpoints in the world than the American viewpoint. And the Islamic world and the Arab world is pretty much fed up with the blind support of the United States for Israel against their interests, or what they perceive as their interests. And it was pretty clear during my time in Saudi Arabia that you know, there was one way of looking at things and there was the real world's way of looking at things. And since then, it's only gotten worse. John Kerry has written a remarkably anti-Arab, and I say anti-Semitic, diatribe in the August 26th edition of The Foreword, in which he castigates all of the Arab world and says Israel is our only true friend, it's the only democratic state in the Middle East, and we therefore should support Israel. And you have statements like the Zelikow, who was, everybody was trying to get off the 9/11 commission, saying that the United States is in Iraq and Afghanistan to protect Israel's interests. And the Arab world and the Muslim world sees this and says, these people are crazy. It's time to hit back. We don't have atomic bombs. We don't have a 600-ship navy. And we don't have Mach 3 jet fighters. We'll use car bombs, we'll use sticks of dynamite, and we'll use airplanes, and we'll try and even the score and get these people's attention. You know, it's kind of like the farmer who bought the world's remaining super jackass. And the thing wouldn't sit, it wouldn't walk, it wouldn't pull, it wasn't housebroken, and it was a very nasty piece of work. And he hired a trainer. And the trainer comes up and looks at this thing and looks at it and walks around and says, walk, and the thing sits, and he says, sits, and the thing walks. So he goes over to his bag of tools and pulls out a Louisville Slugger and slams the thing in the head with all his might. And then he goes back and says to the world's remaining super jackass, do I have your attention?
Thank you.
And I think this is what the Americans have. They have not learned the lesson of the super jackass. They have been slammed repeatedly and still insist on looking at the world through their own particular viewpoint and refusing to believe that there are other interests in the world other than their own.
Thank you. Thank you. Just one quick question for Mike. The hypothesis that some posit is the blowback hypothesis. That is, shame on the U.S. government for arming these guys in the 80s and 90s, but God, we didn't know that they were going to turn on us and fly these planes into the center. Is that a valid hypothesis in your opinion?
I'll try to be as brief in my answer as you were in your question. That's BS. Thank you.
Okay.
Utter nonsense.
Okay. Last question. If Bush wins the election, is there in place the means to proceed immediately with the impeachment of the entire administration?
I have an answer.
I guess we could, yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah. Actually, and from the wilderness, for those of you who are subscribers, you'll know that we've been writing about that scenario for probably 2 years now. The foundation for the impeachment has been impeccably and legally laid by Congressman Henry Waxman of California, who, with House Government Reform Committee, or is it Governmental Affairs, Government Reform Committee, has been documenting all of the lies regarding the forged documents purportedly showing that Saddam Hussein was trying to purchase uranium from Niger, which tied directly into the Valerie Plame case, the outing of the former CIA officer by, we'll just speculate, Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, which are all impeachable and criminal offenses, including perjury. And that record's already in place. And I should add that there's a major historical precedent for this. In 1972, before the 72 election, the Republican National Committee or the White House Plumbers Unit burglarized the Watergate Hotel. Richard Nixon won the 1972 election in a landslide. But the legal work necessary to impeach Richard Nixon was already in place and had been well underway for several years before Nixon eventually resigned in 1974. That is a scenario that may be shaping up here. We may not, there's a lot of problems with the election, vote counting, everything else. We'll ask Cynthia about that. But the issue is this is a knockdown, drag-out fight, and I view the Democrats and the Republicans virtually as the Genovese or the Gambino crime family with little difference, but I think that scenario is in play.
Now we're going to entertain a couple of questions because we're running out of time, and I'm going to try and steal an additional 5 minutes, which means we'll have 10 minutes for your questions, and I said that I was going to have a bunch of questions, and I haven't asked a single one of my questions yet. So anyway, but in deference to you, because you are making this happen, go ahead, Commissioner McIlvaine.
Michael Springman, is it possible not only that visas were given fraudulently, but that identities were laundered or falsified using the U.S. Embassy?
You're saying that were visas issued fraudulently?
Yes.
And identities were falsified?
Or it says here laundered or falsified using the U.S. Embassy.
Well, I was in charge of the section. I had controls over the visa machines. I had the keys to the machines. The local staff were not alone with the machines. So any fraud would have had to have come out from outside the consulate. For example, if somebody presented me with a clean passport and the guy's name was Joe Doakes and the passport was in the name of Rajeep Singh or something, I would have no way of knowing this. We would check the identities of the visa applicants, both approved and refused, with the State Department's computer in Washington. And we would type in the name of the person and the date of birth and the place of birth and so forth and nationality. If we got a hit back, we had further questions, but we had no way of knowing if we had a false identity presented to us for a visa. Mm-hmm. My staff was very good at rooting this out. One fellow, an Indian, brought me a passport one time and said, "Mike, look at this." And I said, "What am I looking at?" And he says, "You see the last page of the passport?" And I said, "Yeah, well, take off your glasses and look real close." And somebody with a marvelous sense of touch had taken a razor blade and cut out the last page where the visa had been stamped refused. But you couldn't see it unless you looked at it almost under a magnifying glass. So, you know, my staff was good at that. We checked with the State Department. If the State Department didn't have the bad guy's name in the file, we couldn't do anything. And as far as the visas that were given out, I resisted this. I had plenty of controls. I looked at the Immigration Act and the State Department regulations, and I did not, under any circumstances, simply say, "Oh, yeah, let's give this guy a visa. Let's make it a Keep America Beautiful visa." So, no. The only problems with the visa process in Jeddah was the fact that I was being ordered by government officials to issue visas to unqualified applicants who later turned out to be terrorists.
Go ahead.
Paul Thompson, what can you tell us about the oil pipeline negotiations a few weeks, the oil pipeline negotiations a few weeks before 9/11 with the Taliban, Russia?
Sure. Yeah. In my book, I have a chapter there called Pipeline Politics, because this is oil is a very big issue. And as many of you may be aware, there were negotiations going on for several years regarding a UNICAL pipeline. There was a gas pipeline. There was an oil pipeline also to go through Afghanistan. Interestingly, and Michael Rupert helped me out in this, is that we find that the estimates of how much oil was in the Caspian Basin that would have gone out through this pipeline were extremely high in the early 90s, and right around the time of 9/11, by 2002, those numbers had changed dramatically, and they found out that so much of that oil actually wasn't there, that the estimates were wildly off. So I think that early on that was important. And as they realized that the oil, the estimates were shrinking every time they would do a new test, we can see that there's a shift of focus from intense interest in the Caspian region to intense interest in Iraq, where they knew that there was a lot of oil. So this you can see this shift, especially in 2002. So certainly, before 9/11, I think that there was some going easy on the Taliban by people in the State Department and other people because they were looking at the oil angle.
All right, one more, Michael Rupert. What is the mechanism by which the military inserted blips onto the civilian radar screens?
Well, specifically in terms of the technology, it's difficult to say. What we do know is that there are several press stories quoting Air Force personnel, specifically from the Northeast Air Defense Sector, and I believe one was a story. Most of these came from the Toronto Star, papers that didn't publish in the U.S. But what it said was it was quoting interviews with Lieutenant Colonel Don Deskins and Colonel Robert Marr of the Northeast Air Defense Sector about how they were wondering if the hijackings were part of the exercise of the drill. And then it says, instantly injects are purged from the radar screen, and then it refers later on. So what we have is a confirmation that there were actual injects placed onto FAA radar screens that day. Now, it's very interesting, parenthetically, and I know we're pressed for time, but it's very important to note that right after I made some presentations about the war games and broke some information about this, it was revealed that a supervisor at the FAA headquarters in Rome, New York, in Northeast Air Defense Sector, had all six air traffic controllers involved on 9/11 sit down and talk about their recollections into a tape recorder that day, while it was still fresh. And right after I broke my stories, the New York Times reported that that tape was taken by that same supervisor, broken, crushed. The tape was cut into little pieces and scattered through various trash cans. But what I was able to do, I think, was make a pretty compelling case that it was an absolute torment for all of the air traffic controllers on 9/11 who were literally looking at their screens going, my God, which are the hijackings? Which is the drill? Where do we send the fighters?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're hearing questions and answers from the 9/11 Citizens Commission hearings held in New York City last month. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio 88.1, Free Radio Olympia 91.3, and on the web, Free Radio Santa Cruz and KFAR Knoxville. We continue with more testimony as Chairperson Cynthia McKinney swears in the next witness.
I will swear for the 3,000.
To tell the truth.
To tell the truth.
Beautiful. Thank you.
And nothing but the truth. My name is Indira Singh. I live and work at Ground Zero. I am a volunteer EMT, or I was prior to 9/11, and I will tell you my story, the story of PTEC. After I fulfill my duties to Siebel Edmonds and read her statement. So first, I would like to take this opportunity to read from Siebel Edmonds' letter to Thomas Keene. I am going to read excerpts of this letter, which is going around the internet, and Siebel is asking everyone, when they receive it, to forward it on to him with your name and comments. These are excerpts from her wonderful letter. Dear Chairman Keene, unfortunately, I find your report seriously flawed in its failure to address serious intelligence issues that I am aware of, which have been confirmed and which, as a witness to the Commission, I made you aware of. Thus, I must assume that other serious issues that I am not aware of were in the same manner omitted from your report. It has been almost 3 years since the terrorist attacks on September 11th. These omissions cast doubt on the validity of your report and therefore on its conclusions and recommendations. After the terrorist attacks of September 11th, we, the translators at the FBI's largest and most important translation unit, were told to slow down, even stop, translation of critical information related to terrorist activities so that the FBI could present the United States Congress with a record of extensive backlog of untranslated documents and justify its request for budget and staff increases. While FBI agents from various field offices were desperately seeking leads and suspects and completely depending on FBI headquarters and its language units to provide them with needed translated information, hundreds of translators were being told by their administrative supervisors not to translate and to let the work pile up. This issue has been confirmed by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Your report has omitted any reference to this most serious issue and has foregone any accountability whatsoever, and your recommendations have refrained from addressing this issue, which, when left unaddressed, will have even more serious consequences.